The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dongshan's Jewel Mirror Samadhi poem. Part 5, Conclusion. If you wish to merge with the ancient track, please contemplate the ancients. The Buddha, on the verge of accomplishing the way, spent 10 kalpas beneath the tree of contemplation. Like a tiger's lame foot, like a shoeless horse. For the benefit of those with inferior ability, there's a jeweled footrest and brocade robes. For the benefit of those capable of wonder, you realize you are like a wildcat or white ox. Yi used his skill as an archer to pierce the target at 100 paces. Two arrow points meeting head-on. How is such great skill attained? The wooden man begins to sing, and the stone woman rises to dance. Since this cannot be understood by reasoning, how can it be analyzed? A minister serves their lord, and a child trusts their parent. It is unfilial not to trust, improper not to serve. Working unobserved, functioning secretly, appearing dull, seemingly foolish. If one can simply persist in that, it is called the host's view of the host. So good morning to all of you who are joining us today. So I've been giving a series of talks on this poem by Master Dongshan, the Jewel Mirror Samadhi, in which he is really speaking about the mutual arising, the codependence, the unity of what we speak of as absolute and relative, or the conventional and the real, the phenomenal and the ultimate. These different ways of speaking about one true thing that is everything. It is Prajnaparamita. It is our own body and mind. It is the reality that appears before us in every instant. I was thinking of this poem as perhaps because of Jinman, thinking about Jinman and his long love affair with music. I was thinking of this poem as a sort of taking the sonata form, musical composition form, where there's a introduction of the theme, which is the Dharma of thusness is intimately conveyed by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it, keep it well. And then there's the development of that theme, which he carries on throughout the whole of the poem. Clearly illuminated just at the middle of the night, it doesn't appear in the morning light. It is a standard for all beings, used to extricate them from all suffering. And then there's the recapitulation, where there's the reintroduction of the theme, which is never really gone away. It's just gone through development. It's been brought out and shown in various aspects, so that that one theme, we see it from all the multitude of its realities. It's likened to the Mani gem, the diamond jewel, that is always just one gem, one jewel, but we need to see it from different perspectives. I remember in my early, for many years, that confused me, because I thought, well, if it's just one reality, one Dharma, how can there be different perspectives? Why isn't there just one perspective? Why isn't it just, if it's one jewel, why isn't there just one view, one reality of it? Because there are. In a way, you could say there is just one view. But that view has to be observed in all of its manifestations, in all of the ways in which it appears, in all of the moments of our lives. That's why it's important to train and practice in all different kinds of situations as much as possible. And we ourselves provide ample opportunities for all different kinds of situations, right? Our mind presents us with a few different perspectives, a few different challenges, and then life embellishes that a bit. You could also say this poem in every, to follow the musical metaphor, is nothing more than the variation on a theme. It's one theme with endless variations. But enough of that. We're walking the Eightfold Path. This very profound, challenging, long Dharma road. Long because we are complex beings. Let's admit it. Not just complicated, but complex. There's a difference. Complicated is what we do, what we create, all of the layers and projections, the things we lay on top. Complex is our mind, our consciousness, the profound and infinite ways in which this one true thing, this mani gem, appears. All of the mutual arising. And so the teachings have to be, in a sense, profound. They have to be both simple and direct, because that is the reality, but they also have to be very demanding. They have to try to speak of what is essentially almost impossible to speak of. Almost impossible. And so that's why we have to keep studying and studying and studying and studying and studying the Dharma with our minds and practicing the Dharma with our bodies and living the Dharma with our lives. And so Dungshan says, if you wish to merge with the ancient track, please contemplate the ancients. And this contemplation means to listen, to encounter the Dharma, to take it in deeply. And so that means when we listen, we should try to be listening with our whole body and mind. That's why when there's a teaching here, we sit in the posture of a Buddha. We sit in the posture of meditation. We are meditating. You know, in the latter years of my training, when I was continuing to study with Dada Roshi, and I would listen to a talk, and my mind would start to slip into, oh, I've heard this story, this koan, this, and I would catch that, because I think if I follow that, then I stop listening. I'm not going to listen anymore. I will shut the door. And every possibility that I have to continue to stay with my teacher, to continue to listen and hear the Dharma, and to hear something new for the first time, that door will shut, and I will have shut it. In the beginning, it was easy to keep it open because everything was new, right? And so then the challenge became, how does it continue to be new? How do I continue to hear it with that kind of mind, with that kind of yearning? And so to contemplate the agents, I think, is, I hear that way. Master Sheng Yen said, we know of the Buddha path, in speaking about this line, he said, we know of the Buddha's path from the sutras. Shakyamuni Buddha describes it. It's the path he has illuminated for us. And although the Chan school avoids attachment to language and symbols, descriptions, it also cautions us not to stray from the sutra's teachings by as much as a single word. And to understand that important dynamic that we are trying to, in practicing, we're practicing the Buddha's teaching. In doing Zazen, we are doing Zazen in accord with the Dharma. If we're not, then we're doing something else. And so to not stray by even a single word at the same time that we're not grasping, attaching, being bound. And it's interesting, I was just reading Paltrow Rinpoche's Words of My Perfect Teacher, and he was talking about sort of decrying seeing at his time, some hundreds of years ago, teachers in prominent positions who were basically using the Dharma and their position to acquire wealth, to acquire status, to acquire fame, to acquire comfort. And that throughout history, that temptation has been and will always be there because it's in us. And so how to stay on the path, true to the Dharma, true to our original intention, and at the same time to not fall into a blind following, a blind faith. What keeps it from being blind is contemplating the ancients, is examining, questioning. And so that very important sort of instruction that first we have to encounter the Dharma, we actually have to hear it, and then we have to reflect on it and really appreciate the importance of that. We have to, in other words, we have to engage it. We have to work at engaging it. What are these teachings saying? How do I understand them? What do these words mean? Right? Why is this metaphor being used? How does this relate to my meditation? How do I understand this in terms of my own, not just my own experience, but my experience and the Dharma? Those two are working together intimately. When they stop working together, we're either following it blindly, it's no longer experiential, or we're just sort of following our own path and we're no longer practicing in accord with the Dharma. And so we raise bodhicitta, we reflect on impermanence, we practice, we verify. And this is how this has come down to us. This is the tradition. This is the tradition. More than the robes and the ways of practicing together, giving a tesho once a week, doing services, having a memorial service when somebody passes, doing sesshin. All of those are essential, but the real tradition that is being passed down, the living part of it, is contemplating the ancients. And contemplate here is dynamic, it's robust, it's whole body and mind. And in that way, the teachings become alive in you, in me. They become alive. You know, think about how in the course of a talk or reading a teaching or chanting a sutra, that all of these words are being heard, all of these words are passing by, but then in one moment, one phrase, zing, pierces you. Wakes up your mind, shifts something. There's insight. Why? Why that moment? Why that phrase? That's the moment of the teachings coming alive. The Buddha, on the verge of accomplishing the way, spent 10 kalpas beneath the tree of contemplation. And so it's said that the Buddha spent countless lives before, as a bodhisattva, before he was born as Shakyamuni, appearing in all of these different forms as animals and human beings and all different kinds of life situations, experiencing all different kinds of challenges, hardships, adversities, and always, each of those lifetimes, was being used to develop himself as a bodhisattva, to develop his path, to encounter whatever was going on as a way to practice. And that's what allowed him to eventually be born as the Buddha Shakyamuni and to realize his great enlightenment. Dogen said, once you see or hear the true teaching, you should practice it without fail. One phrase offered by a loyal servant can have the power to alter the course of a nation. One word given by a Buddha ancestor cannot fail to turn a person's mind. The unwise ruler does not adopt the servant's advice. One who does not step forward cannot accept the Buddha's teaching. If you are unbending, you cannot stop floating along in birth and death. If appropriate advice is not heeded, governing with virtue cannot be realized. And so we're really being constantly challenged to bend. If we are unbending, we cannot step forth. We cannot, and if we can't step forth, then we can't encounter the Dharma. And we can think of stepping forth as stepping forward from the place of our clinging, of our attachment, of our nest. It's in that stepping forth that we then can contemplate, we can reflect, we can examine, we can engage. And so the importance of developing pliancy, you know, to really think about that as we're meditating, as we're doing zazen, as we're developing our mindfulness and our concentration. Because in trying to develop that sincerely, earnestly, not, you know, in a very conscientious way, because we encounter so much energy of our mind, right, the forces, the currents, the tides of our karmic patterns, right, all the thought streams and the emotions and the memories and the distractions and just the force of that. Right? And as we're genuinely trying to meet that and develop mindfulness, right, to not just waver and wander in every moment, but actually to be able to hold that object, the breath, and develop some constancy, that in that effort, it's very common that we will become less pliant, less flexible. We become a little tight and rigid, too taut, the Buddha said. And then in noticing that, the practice is to relax, right? Too taut, the string breaks. Too loose, no sound. And so we have to relax. But then when we relax, our association with that is going to sleep, becoming dull, becoming complacent. And so when we see that, then we have to tighten the string a little bit, right? And so we waver, we wander, we swing, right? And in that, we're cultivating pliancy. We're learning how to bend, right? So it's not too tight, but it's not too loose. And it's an exquisite place of aliveness and that inhabits the whole body and mind and frees us from so much of the embodied turmoil and stress and pressure and tension. Dungshan says, like a tiger's lame foot, like a shoeless horse. And so he's describing creatures who are hobbled in a sense, unable to gain footing, unable to move freely. The tiger is a powerful being, the horse is fast. It's their nature. But they're held back by having a hurt foot, by not having proper shoes. And so if we're aiming to walk this path, but are not relying upon the Dharma, are not trusting the Dharma, not taking refuge in the Dharma, then we'll take refuge in something else. It's pretty much a certainty, right? Because we're going to rely on something. When we say, to develop right understanding, that's coming from a place of already having a fully built system of understanding, right? Nobody comes into practice without understanding. We begin developing understanding the moment we have consciousness. and particularly as language starts to be learned. So that's why the Buddha said right understanding. To correct the ways in which our present understanding is not serving us, is not in accord. And so if we're not taking refuge in what the teachings are saying and how they're guiding us, then we'll take refuge in something else. And that something else is, you know, pretty predictable. It's what we already know. It's what we've already used and done and have found some, you know, success with, because that's why we keep using it. And so that's so much of the trust, is being willing to be at that very junction and realize we're at a junction, right? Where we have to make a choice. Do I actually trust the Dharma, even though my inner inclination is no, right? It doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel easy. It's strange, right? Because it's a new path. Or do I trust what is familiar? And so for the benefit of those with inferior ability, Dungshan says, there's a jeweled footrest and a brocade robe. And there's lots of references in the teachings to those, you know, to practitioners of different abilities. Sort of inferior, middling, and superior is usually how it's presented. You know, and it's a little distressing to hear that, because it's like, okay, I'm almost certainly inferior, middling at best, you know, and like, how great is that, you know? I'm definitely not of superior quality. So it's always a little bit like, oh, well. And that, what is it really talking about, you know? I mean, is it talking about, you know, that you have to have a certain IQ, you have to have a certain, you know, something? Or is it really talking about, you know, is that ability, you know, we have to have a certain sort of set of instruments and equipment to, like, do the work. But is it really, in a sense, the capacity that our karma, what we've done with our lives, what our lives have done to us, how we've responded, and how tight that knot is. You know, so if we come in justifiably because of our life's conditions, finding it very difficult to trust for good reason, but if that's our karma, then it's going to be more difficult to trust, right? Shouldn't be a mystery. But it will make certain things harder, right? It will mean there will be certain things we will need to do to really develop that trust, because it's so important. And so for the benefit of those with inferior ability, there's a jeweled footrest and brocade robes, which basically means this. I mean, this is the jeweled footrest, basically, for us. The throne, the, you know, the stuff, what Dido used to sometimes call the razzle-dazzle. The robes, the incense, the altars. All right. And so it seems that almost all practitioners throughout the history have been of inferior ability, since these have been provided since early on. In other words, the things, the objects, the sacred objects that we use in practice to direct our attention, right? To cultivate relationship with, to begin to investigate what is Buddha, to investigate what is sacred, to investigate reverence, right? In my early training, when I heard that word, it was like, whoa, just keep that over there. Reverence to me just smelled a lot like being holy and caught up in something. I saw it as a kind of disempowerment somehow. I didn't understand it. I didn't know what it was. I just had that association. I didn't understand it. And I didn't, in a way, understand that I had already experienced that for other things that I had trust in, faith in, things that I saw as not religious, not spiritual. And so we cultivate all of these important aspects of our being, which really are important because they bring us into intimate contact with everything. And in that contact, now we understand reverence. Now we understand sacred. Now we understand the inherent dignity of all things, the aliveness of all things. And so as practitioners, you know, and some teachers and centers have responded to this by just getting rid of all of that. In fact, there are some ads you'll see for centers that say, you know, we're, in so many words, you know, we have freed ourselves of robes and all the razzle-dazzle, and it's just pure Dharma, pure Zen, right? And I understand that. Because it's so easy to get trapped. And in a certain way, you know, as we develop and if we have found our path and we are entering into it deeply, it's almost certain that we will form attachments. I mean, it is certain. Let's just make it more clear. We will form attachments, right? How could we not? Right? Particularly if something means something, is so important, is so meaningful. That's what we do. That's what we know. And in a way, it's dangerous, and in a way, it's okay. Because the more it matters, when we become attached to that, the more powerful it is when we recognize that and we begin to free ourselves of it. And as we do that of the things that don't matter that much to us, we're learning how to do it with those things that are of utmost importance to us. And there will still be things that are the greatest challenge. Oftentimes, parents bring that up in terms of their children. And I'm like, yeah. I'm not even going to tell you not to be attached to your kids. But watch out, because it actually is not going to help anybody. And so he says, for the benefit of those capable of wonder, which I think, looking at it for the vast, vast majority of practitioners, we begin, as we would say, of inferior ability, which just means we begin. We begin as beginners. We begin as we must. We begin where we are, to work towards being one who is capable of wonder. And then, Dongchan says, we realize, oh, all along we were a wildcat. All along we were a white ox. All along, it was not the way we thought. Dogen says, in his fascicle on Taking Refuge, it is clear that what the Buddha and ancestors in India and China and all of the places where Buddha Dharma has landed have authentically transmitted is reverence for Buddha Dharma and Sangha. Without taking refuge, there is no reverence. Without reverence, there's no taking refuge. So here he makes this very intimate connection between taking refuge and cultivating reverence. And I think for many of us, that's how we learn what reverence really is by taking refuge. He says, the act of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha is achieved through mutual affinity and interaction. Whether you're in a deva realm, a human realm, a hell realm, a demon realm, an animal realm, when you have mutual affinity and intimate contact with Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you invariably will take refuge in them. And so this is a way in, a pathway, you might say. to being in the world and within this person in a very different way through the practice of taking refuge. Dogen says, the Buddha said, many of you are fearful of suffering and take refuge in mountains and gardens and forests, under trees or in shrines. These refuges are neither excellent nor valuable. You cannot be liberated from suffering by taking refuge in them. On the other hand, if you take refuge in the Buddha and if you take refuge in Dharma and Sangha, you can always abide in the Four Noble Truths. Within this wisdom, you can observe and understand suffering. You can contemplate the path of the ancients. And the arising of suffering, you know how to go beyond suffering forever. This is the Eightfold Path. This refuge is the most excellent, most valuable of all. And so we can understand mountains and gardens, forests, taking refuge under trees or in shrines, as taking refuge in a job or a relationship or money or possession or power or title, youthfulness, success, beauty, intellectual power, distractions. And none of these are intrinsically problematic. All of these have a place, we might say. And yet what the Buddha is saying is none of them are inherently satisfying. None of them will actually bring us closer in an ultimate sense to what we seek. Dongshan says, Yi used his skill. Yi was a historical master archer to pierce the target at 100 paces. Two arrow points meeting head on. How is such great skill attained? The relative and the absolute, like two arrows meeting in midair. Impossible. Perfect attunement, perfect accord. It's already happened. It's happening in every moment. So that we can see that directly, so that we can live that, we practice exactly that. We practice bringing two arrow points to meet. When you sit within your body of Buddha and you are not too tight or too loose, when something arises that seems to have the power to obstruct, and you do not hate it or deny it, and you do not cling and grasp after it and try and possess it, this is two arrow points meeting in midair. It's not yet realized, but it's right there, which is the only way it can be realized. And it's why in those moments, you know, it's like when you tune a stringed instrument, like a violin, and the violinist is moving the bow across two strings. And as they tune one string, you can hear it going from discord, and then it and it's a perfect harmony. And you hear it. And not only do you hear it, but you feel it. And the violin starts to vibrate, right? It comes alive. You feel it. It's like that. That's two arrow points meeting. In the same way that when you move the peg so that the string moves out of that harmony, you feel that too, right? We call it discord. We call it disharmony. And so developing this skill as these archers, these master archers, is our everyday bread and butter. It's what we do. It's what we practice. Until that skillfulness, right, begins to dissolve into what we call ordinary mind, into everyday life, everyday activity, Layman Pong said, "My daily activities are not unusual. I'm just naturally in harmony with them, grasping nothing, discarding nothing. In every place, there's no hindrance, there's no conflict. My supernatural power and marvelous activity, drawing water, chopping wood." Dongshan says, "It's like the wooden man beginning to sing and the stone woman jumps up and begins to dance." Right? What is dead, what is lifeless, what is free of any characteristic, what is lacking warmth, characteristics of the characteristic less that we use to describe the absolute, suddenly begins to sing, suddenly stands and comes to life. A very powerful image, right, of two arrow points meeting. Of how that which is free of life and death, which is unborn and undying, lives. Dongshan says, "It's not attained in thought or feeling. It cannot be understood by reasoning. So how can it be analyzed?" Which is another way of saying reflection, contemplating, is not analyzing in the way that we normally did, picking it apart, dissecting it. You know, the reason I came into Buddhist practice really disliking poetry was because, in a sense, I'd never really actually encountered poetry yet. The classes that I had in high school in poem and the poetry that I encountered in grade school, the way that it was handled was like taking a living frog and cutting it down the middle and splaying it out and pinning it to a dissection board. And it was like, ugh, it's dead. And fortunately, through lots of support and help, and Allen Ginsberg, actually, a national treasure, I was able to hear poetry for the first time. And I realized, oh, why didn't you tell me it's music? Why didn't you tell me it's just singing? A minister serves their Lord and a child trusts their parents. It's unfilial not to trust, improper not to serve. Here again, these images of absolute and relative. Master Linji spoke of it in terms of guest and host. This intimate relationship between a parent and a child. Actually, I confess that I changed the words a little bit. A child, it says, and a child must obey their parent. Which from the parent's point of view is probably pretty accurate. But how we tend to hear obey is kind of being in servitude. As being without choice. Dadaroshi always wanted to make it very clear that the monastic vow of service is not a vow of obedience. Although the vow of obedience, I'm sure, is understood within the Catholic Church in ways that is not servitude. But it's really talking about this essential relationship. Right? That although historically is based in Confucianism within the development of Chan, was seen as I understand it, as part of the natural order of things, of the universe. It's the way, it's a manifestation of how the universe works. And if we don't live in accord with that, then the universe starts to come apart. Yeah, seems like that actually happens. Seems like that actually is happening. When something essential is not understood and lived in accord with. Then there will be much pain and suffering and confusion. And so to understand ourselves and to let those two arrow points meet, to be the stone woman coming to life and dancing within our body and mind, and at the same time, to be doing that in intimate contact with each other. And to be doing that, to find that, be able to recognize that harmony, that attunement in the midst of so much discord, so much disharmony, can only be done experientially. We cannot analyze our way to that. The great way is perfect like vast space. There is nothing in excess and there is nothing lacking. I consider that one of the most important teachings of that Faith Mind poem and one of the most dangerous. Because if we misunderstand that, we can take that as falsely to say everything is fine, everything is perfect, and just die there. Which has nothing to do with Buddha Dharma. But to think of the essential order of things that recognizes time and place and relationships and positions and all the stuff that we make and construct in our world, in our ordinary world, in our Dharma world. And that when our relationship with the brocade robe, the jeweled footrest, the altars, the images, when that is not in attunement, our Dharma practice will suffer, actually. And the Dharma will begin to turn subtly into a kind of poison. The Dharma is not doing anything, right? It's in our mind. And so that, in a very real sense, is the challenge for us as practitioners is to, that's what keeping it alive is. That's our responsibility, I feel, as practitioners. Is as we are liberating ourselves and liberating our others, we keep the Dharma in our mind liberated. We don't turn it into something in our mind that it isn't. We don't try and appropriate it. We don't try and use it for something that it's not. Working unobserved, functioning secretly, appearing dull, seemingly foolish. If you can simply persist in this, then you will be the host seeing the host. You will be called a master among masters. And so this is the, in Buddhism, this is the fruition, the full fruit. Working unobserved, functioning secretly, right? No billboards, no neon signs. No pronouncements, no declarations, no fanfare, no throwing of flower petals as you walk. Functioning secretly, appearing dull, seemingly foolish, simple. One moment, one step, one action, one response. Not needing to succeed. Not fretting over failure, caring so deeply that it breaks your heart, feeling unable in humility to alleviate the suffering of the world. What could you possibly do? And being so utterly committed to alleviating the suffering of the world that you cannot do nothing. We think of the master, diplomat, politician, artist, scientist, as the one who has achieved great success and position. But in Dharma practice, it's like, you know, we come in from samsara with lots of shine. We're all shiny. Right? Because that's what's valued. And in practice, what happens is that shine, it's like the patina. You know, it's like the copper on the Jizo house. It's so beautiful, shiny, brilliant. But actually, as it gets more and more dull, it becomes more and more beautiful. I made the mistake once and only once. And I say this so that it will never be done again. When I was the workmaster, of taking upon myself of polishing the Buddha image in the Buddha hall because it had clearly been neglected for so many years. I will leave it to your imagination what my teacher's response was. He was actually quite kind. And I realized, oh, you are really practicing patience right now. I didn't understand. I thought we were striving for the shine. And so in the 10th oxidating picture, the end of the journey. Barefooted and naked of breast, I mingle with the people of the world. My clothes are ragged and dust-laden, and I am ever blissful. I have no use of magic to extend my life. Now before me, the dead trees become alive. My hope is that we can really live our lives appreciating this Dharma. A profound teaching that is so dedicated to making itself available, to alleviating suffering, to awakening our minds, and at every step has such a deep understanding that it's not about it. It's not about it. It's about you. It's about this. And may we be ever clear in that.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.